And welcome to The Gods Will Not Save You. I'm Willie Romano Pugh.
Hi, this is Jakob. This is the podcast where we will do a deep read into each and every episode of the hit HBO show, The Wire.
Please donate at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. We really appreciate all the love that has been shown from our donors so far. And give us 5 stars on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify. Any platform you listen to this on. And with that, let's get into season 3, episode 4, Hamsterdam.
We have the man of the hour, Colvin. Well, he's not necessarily in charge of leading. Colvin is at the community meeting. He has to step in because his sergeant is basically just, he's getting destroyed by the crowd.
Right. He's saying all the... I mean, it just kind of like goes in with the whole thing that Richard Price brought up, that a lot of this show is about getting embarrassed in front of your peers at a middle school classroom by an authority figure. Like if this was like a CompStat meeting and that sergeant was like saying all this stuff about statistics, they'd be like given high praise. But since this is like people who are like living the reality in their day-to-day life, they're getting torn to shreds. And Bunny, in kind of like an ironic twist, says something similar to what he presented in CompStat and is like given like a sense of approval by the community as opposed to when he like gave his little presentation to Rawl. So nice little reversal we got going on.
Bunny, the master of not only community policing, well, I don't know if I have all the, like the facts and metrics to back that up, but community CompStatting, he's definitely excelling at. And we got some politicians, or at least one politician and a hopeful politician, Marla, in the back with Carchetti, and they're observing what's happening. Also, William Gant's cousin is there. They're, you know, still committed to confusing or, you know, dropping in these little details to make sure we're paying attention and so forth.
Repeat viewings give exponential rewards, I must say. What's up with, so Carchetti is there kind of trying to get a sense of the lay of the land. He's not even in his district. It is like kind of like a precursor to him, like announcing his mayoral campaign. He's there with Marla, just kind of observing. And the way he like stared, like there's kind of like a symbiotic like ambition for reform that they both have, albeit they're going to go at it in different ways. And they're kind of like dropping hints that like Carchetti and Colvin might like team up, or like they're two peas in a pod, or they have like, you know, similar ideas. And that turns out to be kind of like the hope for that, you know, it ends up to be dashed, or, you know, we get disappointed by their potential team up. But the way Carchetti like is staring at Colvin as he leaves the room, like what's up with Carchetti's stare? Like we see him like kind of leering at that redhead in the last episode, like we see him looking at Teresa D'Agostino later on. Like he's a lot more like predatory than I remember.
He's even, if he's predatory, or I mean, yeah, he looks the part in certain contexts. Pretty eerie stuff Carchetti gets around. So who has the, whose hood pass is more legit, Carchetti or Nick Sabaka? Because Nick will be everywhere too. He'll just like, oh, I'm gonna go pick up, I'm gonna go to the furniture store on the west side, I'm gonna drive to the hood with Lala, you know. And Carchetti just like, you know, driving around West Baltimore, he doesn't have his aide or anything, right? He just kind of pulled up to a community center. So
I mean, they're both doing it kind of for show though, so I'd say neither, because Nick is just like trying to do it because he's trying to prove how tough he can be. Marchetti is doing that because he wants to gain a lot of people's trust and seem like he's a politician for all people, but we see him kind of sell his soul later on down the political line. Yeah continuing on with Bunny.
Yeah so he says something pretty, you know, important, that whatever the solution is, it can't be a lie. So we can't, we know that the plan he has in store for the you know, creation of the title of this episode, or, you know, we learned the legend behind that, but his plan is unfolding in front of us. But before that, he has a nice little breakfast meeting. I know you're a breakfast guy, right? I mean, we look forward to going out, you know, going to a diner's, RIP cafe or Last Stop 101. Capital I 101. But what do you think about his meeting with the academic types?
They're pretty annoying people, and I kind of sympathize with his disgust that a grown man would say that he has to go tinkle.
All right. I mean, he did say, you know, like, oh, he had to tinkle. I don't know. Did he need to make a dookie? And I'm like, yeah. Is that a word that is off limits for, you know, I'm pretty sure I probably said that. Not like personally stating that to someone. That's a little odd, but... You know, just the word. It's also a Green Day album, right? Or
I mean, it sounds like silly, and we're obviously like having fun with it, but it does kind of like illustrate a fundamental difference of vernacular or whatever that Colvin feels kind of like he's really burnt out by his current job and is feeling like he's kind of having an existential crisis of like whether or not he did anything to make a difference in his neighborhood. But then like when he gets introduced to these academic types, he's like, you know, potentially going to get a security job at Johns Hopkins University and it'll be a great like post-retirement gig. But at the same time, he's like, oh God, these people are fucking insufferable. Like this is what I'm going to have to like deal with. So yeah, it illustrates that pretty perfectly, I gotta say. So
yeah, and he's learning from his ex-cop buddy. I forget exactly who he is, but that, you know, no matter how they talk or whatnot, they're in control of distributing the funds in the city, really. I mean, they're cutting the big checks, and you know, they're Johns Hopkins, we know they're the one who's they really run the city in a lot of ways without actually having to participate in a lot of the things that, you know, someone in that or an entity in that situation would have to do, right? As far as maybe taxes are concerned, real estate stuff. But
be careful what you say, dude. I hope no Johns Hopkins stans are listening to this podcast.
They're like, you're too critical. You're trying to call out that we're destroying neighborhoods and, you know, raising certain parts of East Baltimore. Okay, it's a whole different topic, but it's all connected, man, you know?
So, yeah, he's having the meeting with the academic types, getting kind of a lay of the land of what his post-retirement life will look like. But in the meantime, he's trying to push radical reform in his job that has a expiring shut, like he's retiring soon. So he's pushing his ambitious plan to get a lot of these drug dealers that he sees, you know, out on the block in his patrols, and he's trying to get them all in a concentrated area where they can sell drugs in an abandoned, you know, it's like an abandoned neighborhood on Vincent Street.
I mean, I know that that's one of the big criticisms, you know, as far as this season's concerned and Simon's angle, where you just have, you know, a third of the city. O'Malley had declared, you know, drug-free zone, so you could get arrested for just looking at a cop if you're standing in that area, you know, whether if you live there or not or whatnot. Can Carver just indict a coroner on his own? I feel like the process is more in depth than that if it's not already indicted. You know, I guess maybe he's referring to what's already in place, like the coroner's no-go zone. Yeah, so this is kind of where we get the infamous background on the creation of Amsterdam, right? Where they're trying to, he and Calicio, the geo geniuses, right? They're like, Switzerland, you know, they're like, what? Yeah. Amsterdam, one of those countries with the with legalized drugs, because, you know, Amsterdam's its own thing. It's not part of an actual country with, you know, its own regulations and laws that might be different. I also love it because both of those, you know, areas, you know, Switzerland, of course, being a country, it's like part of my heritage, you know? So I'm thinking like, wow, what does that say about me? That like the two places they're mentioning that where you can apparently it's just full of junkies and whatnot is like pretty much my entire background. They fight drugs a different way. Like, you know, it's more of a health issue. All I know is in Amsterdam, well, we all know about that. They don't really find the tourists who come there to indulge in those things to be the most, earnest types. Like, oh, there goes people. They had too much psychedelic truffles again, like leapt off of a second floor, brothel, leapt out of the window on the second floor of the red light district. No, I'm serious. People come, not saying names. Maybe they're like, come there and just like dive into canals, tripping on acid and stuff. But definitely, because Amsterdam is its own country. It's not, and if you ask people, they're like, oh, it's Dutch. Oh, Danish, right? It's in Denmark. Yeah, sure.
But so we see the plan kind of go awry in a lot of ways with the drug dealers not heeding the warnings of the police officers and like what to do, because they're kind of thrown off by this whole confusing approach. So Bunny tries to take matters into his own hands and gets like a bunch of school buses to take them to like a school cafeteria to lecture them on like what to do and how to do it. And I gotta say, being in this situation for me personally, where I was just getting like dunked on by a bunch of like middle and high schoolers, is way more terrifying to me than having to go toe to toe with Rawls and Burrell. And I kind of feel that like maybe Colvin feels a similar way too, because he needs to have backup in the form of like a school principal come in and, you know, get things into shape a little bit. in this instance, like the whole analogy that like life is just, you know, getting embarrassed in middle school for not doing your homework. This is literally him getting embarrassed in a middle school, and it's a fucking terrifying situation.
Yeah. So have you been in that situation, or you're just saying like the prospect of it, like you would rather go before Rawls and those kids?
I think so. Because it's like, it's like getting humiliated by a bunch of kids just seems like my nightmare, I think, because I'm already like afraid of the youth in a lot of ways.
I mean, it's not as bad as like, it's bad, but like once you just like, I don't know, maybe I got more experience like humiliating myself in other ways. So like, it wasn't that as bad, but you know, I mean, that's a pretty extreme scenario. Especially because all the kids, basically, that's what I was going to ask you, you know, is this kind of foreshadowing some of the educational storylines like in season 4? Because this seems like a supersized version of the kids. You know, they're taking what, the 4 or 5 crazy kids from each class and putting them in his program. This is like pretty much all of that times 10 in one location. So good stuff though, you know, great, the principal. So she comes in to tell them to shut up, basically, and that he wasn't in school. She calls one kid out to, you know, humiliate them and then set the tone. Given the context, does she not understand, you know, why they're all there, that they're pretty much corner boys? And that's like, that pretty much explains why he wasn't at school, right? Because he's now basically in a meeting for drug dealers, you know? So why, like, I mean, she has to know what's going on, or was there some miscommunication? Was he just like, hey, I just want to talk to the youth of our community about some general programs that are available to them, not about drugs?
I think maybe she was a little vague on the, like, she wasn't totally filled in on like what the context of the assembly was all about. But I just want to give a shout out to Vera Holly, looking at her IMDb right now. The Wire is her only acting credit. So I'm assuming she was like a Baltimore native or local that was a non-actor that was just cast for her presence and kind of authoritative manner. I think she does a really great job in this scene.
Good stuff. I mean, she probably, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if she's actually like a AP or assistant principal or principal. I mean, I don't want to assume she's not the principal, but you know, the way she's going after it, definitely she knows what's up. Also, I'm disappointed because for some reason, since watching this show the first time, I didn't pick up on the name for school buses, and I haven't been calling them cheese boxes for the last decade. Man, look at that cheese box.
I was in charge of like hiring a principal at a school or something, and Vera Holly came in and I was taking a look at her resume, and I saw that she acted in this scene from season 3, episode 4, The Wire, Amsterdam, I definitely would feel like, oh, this is a great qualification. Yeah, I want her to be on the staff.
Let's talk about Cuddy's storyline. Cuddy is working the bag. Man, he's displaying some of those skills. Cuddy's nutrition is on point though, right? He got that jail food. You got that jail food. Okay, apparently it's working though, because he's
solid, built like a rock, but he cannot do manual labor. He doesn't work a lawnmower. You know, it's kind of interesting. He shows his strength like out in the ring or with that heavy bag. But when it comes to like doing like yard work, it just goes to show you like, you know, like there's a lot of like, there's even some people we know that they're like, oh yeah, I get all my exercise or like I get all my work in by just like doing.
Working a real job.
Yeah, working a real job, like you know, window tinting or.
Oh, that is, he's strong, like he can do the labor, it's just he doesn't necessarily have the I don't know what you call it, landscape intellect to know you got to prime it three times, which I grew up with like a push mower, but you know me, I'm basically Amish in some ways, so I wouldn't know like the whole, oh my god, look at this piece of technology. He's also been, I'm assuming if he was like on a work detail in the cut, they didn't have like the most high-tech, you know, lawnmowers available and whatnot.
So the guy that hired him for the job recognizes that you know, Cuddy has spent some time in jail like he has, and he kind of gives him a reality check that there's not going to be like a big reward necessarily for going the straight life, but it's just going to be like a series of days like these with, you know, good, hard, honest work. And that immediately, as you say, it calls him to get back in the game, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, he was getting laughed at by the, you know, the guys are in the Rover or whatever while he's in the back of that truck bed, which by the way is a very secure, like at this point, is getting back in the game more dangerous than getting driven to work in an unsecured truck bed every day? I mean, it's like, what a, you know, okay, pretty dangerous on the streets of Baltimore, but what does that speak to as far as the you know, the state of the city, where you could just pretty much drive around as if you're almost like, it's like a country road, it's just, you know, boarded up row houses and stuff, no one's gonna bother you. It kind of reminded me too of in Charm City, where they're going on their, you know, completely different context, but they do their neighborhood cleanup and they kind of just ride in the back of the truck bed, you know, every day, Willie, every day. And then immediately he just hops off the back of the truck bed and picks up that payphone. So he can't get a hold of Slim, but then Cuddy just uses his like sonar to just hone in exactly to the corner where Slim, Charles, and Bodie are. Bodie has now an off-brand corner on Carrollton Street. So we know that's on the west side, and that David Simon and the production crew are not still playing their little hopper game, switching sign, street signs. It's around the corner from the Poppleton and Fayette corner, which is really on Federal and Bond on the east side. It's like, it's on Oliver and Bethel. These old corner stores, really, they're great with for landmark purposes as far as figuring out where Bodie is, but everything's been moved to the east side for production. I understand. But yeah, Bodie's got a lot to say to OG Cuddy here. You know, it's a little detail I kind of missed too, or earlier about Cuddy sparring with the Bodie's brother, but just the kind of the layers of Bodie's life, you know, not to forgive him for what he did to Wallace, but you know, all the trauma that he's experienced, I'm sure it's all weighed heavy on him, but we're going to see how real Cuddy really is moving forward here with the situation with the guy who owes them money. So then they get to show Cuddy a good time, or I mean, others will show him a good time, but they, you know, Bodie and Slim, Charles kind of facilitate this crazy party. Is it, I mean, I forget how crazy this scene is, in that is like a house party. It's not a club, it's not a house party, it's just some club music extravaganza orgy,
and there's lots of like slow motion and POV shots kind of breaking up with the usual house style of The Wire filmmaking. So that's how you know it's getting crazy.
Oh, yeah. That's how we know. My question really, what do you think Big G, Anwan Big G Glover, Slim Charles, thinks about being in this crazy club party, Baltimore club music party? He's probably like, where's the go-go at, man? Yeah, he's a really famous, I mean, at least in DC and the areas that, you know, really rock with the go-go, he's, you know, his name is Big G in those circles, I believe. You know, I'm sure he has other nicknames, but he performs with Backyard Band. And we know how people in Baltimore, especially Stringer, feel. And he can't stand that go-go. So I always wanted to know, like, what the back and forth would have been like. But, I mean, Cuddy seems to be enjoying himself.
He does, but at the same time, he seems just like, what the fuck is happening? Like, this is like a level of hedonism that has previously been unearthed.
Yeah, because he's surprised that Avon's allowing them to actually get their head up. And he doesn't seem to be like someone who, you know, drinks regularly or does drugs. Even though they're just smoking a blunt, right? They're not like, it's not like a Stinkum Weebe party in season one where they're doing a bunch of lines and stuff.
Anyway, we got Bubs doing some gig work for McNulty and Kima at $5 an hour. Resident snitch again. Kind of like further... You know, it's another thing, like when you watch this show so many times, the first time it didn't completely dawn on me like how exploitative McNulty and Kima are at Bubs, and like it's like contradictory the fact that they're like trying to bring down drug organizations, but they're kind of relying on Bubs to continue his habit in order for him to like provide decent information what's going on in the neighborhood. And yeah, really, like, I mean, inflation, you know, different times, 2004, but $5 an hour. I don't know what the minimum wage is in Maryland, but that seems kind of, and for the work he's doing, like he got them the information about Marlo Stanfield. Like, it's fucking a crazy find. And he's getting paid $30 a day for that stuff.
Yeah, he does say it's below the minimum wage, right? So, yeah. You know, like Simon always says, the hardest job is being a junkie or whatnot in inner city or wherever, I'm assuming. So, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just depends. Like we know, you and I have learned there is apparently a conservative fan base of The Wire. Yeah. They're probably, I've disappointed all the libertarians. Simon would say, I'm like, oh, I didn't know they're into it. I guess the whole like drug aspect of it, you know, like abolish, you know, the war on drugs and whatnot. But you know, the redemptive arc of Bubbles, you know, pulling himself up, you know, they'd say he should be lucky to have, you know, that like it's untaxed, right? I mean, he's like basically 1099 in, right? Could write off some stuff. The phones, you know, like he doesn't have a phone bill, but some wise guy or wise person told me once, you know, you got to start your own business, like a side hustle, so you can just write off your cell phones because then that's your business phone. But this I just got a question. Do you think that this conservative fan base of The Wire that we know, do you think that they would be also disappointed in someone like Bubbles aside from...
Oh, that he hasn't had, like he hasn't been on paper as having a real job for a long time.
Get a real job. No, I was going to say, maybe I buried the lead or the punchline, that he's at the forefront of capsule culture. Bubbles is all about that capsule culture. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, Bubs, man, he's got to get a real job again someday because it's been years, right? We never know. I mean, he's a smart guy. Like you said, he does a huge solid for McKima, Greg Nolte. he gets some Marlowe's plates, which just invaluable information about the streets and the current state of affairs.
Right. I can relate to Bubbles in that way because I also used to be pretty good at memorizing license plate, like my 2000 Lincoln Mercury Cougar. That was like 4KJN560. Pretty valuable that he's able to get the, you know, letters and numbers of like who is kind of like the new head honcho in town. which Vernon Holly refers to as what does he call him, the spawn of the devil. Says that motherfucker is real, and it's telling that the detail is again like setting themselves behind by misunderstanding, thinking that Marlowe is working with Stringer, still not like grasping the fundamental idea that there's always going to be, it's like a cyclical thing. It's a really good get that Bubbles gets for them. And I'd say it's worth a lot more than $30 a day. Fuck that.
I mean, you want to make real money, you got to get a real job. So, just doing his thing. But, Bubbles does mention someone who's, who else is on the corners of Fremont, or in that area. You know, because we know they're all on the west side. By the way, I was going to say that even if Bodie, you know, isn't really on Carrollton, he's actually on the east side around the area where they're filming stuff for Marlowe's Corner in Amsterdam. I do appreciate the scale because roughly, you know, the distance where he actually set up his shop on the east side, it's like pretty much comparable to how far Carrollton would be from Poppleton and Fayette, which is where Marlowe's Corner is really supposed to be. So I do appreciate that, even if it's like not in the actual space. But he mentions another guy, Gangster Webster. Oh, let me tell you about this guy, Gangster Webster. No, he's pretty gangster. You know, just a little, another shout out to the universe. So serious drug player back in the 70s because he got busted in the late 70s, I think 1979, and he got a really long jail sentence. So his drug outfit, they were selling 6 pounds of coke and heroin a month in Baltimore. That seems like a lot. Yeah. But then maybe it's because my like a kilo is 2.2 pounds, right? So it's like when you hear like, oh, I got 5 keys, that's quite a lot. That's like more than 10 to 11 pounds. So, you know, 6 pounds, that's a lot. But apparently also in some other case, I don't know if it was that drug case, but there was a witness who was shot, or he had someone killed. A guy who did it apparently was named Anthony Grandison. And that guy, I think I mentioned, he was friends, or he was in a crew with the Ghost, who was mentioned a couple of times, like early on. And another guy named Vernon Collins, who's I think known as Bay Brother, who's like a pretty much a mass murderer. So like they say, Baltimore's not that big. So yeah. And like you had mentioned, brilliantly kind of tied in the whole you know, Cuddy's phone call to Slim, maybe went to a burner that's been tossed. So he gives them pretty good insight, even though the details going to know more information about the burners and stuff. But
we could just go down the list and talk about Bunk next. Trying to find the missing gun that was involved in the Dozerman shooting and kind of going on a wild goose chase, pulling out all the magic trick, pulling on, you know, using all the tricks of the trade that he can imagine. It's a fruitless task in a lot of ways because finding, you know, one gun in a city like Baltimore, it's just like, it's like a stupid symbolic task that they don't want the police department to seem weak, that their service weapon is like out there being used, so they send Bunk on this thankless task.
So what is this? This is all just like to show the discord in the police department and how their like draconian tactics don't actually.
I'd say so, because later on when he's drinking heavily with Jimmy in the bar, he brings up the real police work that he has to do with those two people that got killed in the shootout in Pimlico.
Yeah, Stash House Heaven, Pimlico. How many stash houses are in Pimlico in the show? Like pretty much all important stashes. Sorry.
But yeah, he's like, you know, that's the instance of where he's like trying to shake off, you know, the shitty part of his day job where he's taking part in just like a grinding wheel of, you know, thankless whatever, and he's like actually trying to get the real work done and bribe Jimmy into giving him up information about Omar so that he could put that red ball to bed, which by the way, like Jimmy doesn't even have any more information about Omar at this point.
Jimmy is busy doing a lot of other police work, trying to finally, you know, get a lineup on String again so he can close the case that he finds to be worthy of working on, which leads to some know, pretty tense moments in the detail.
Yeah, this is like the first time where we've seen Jimmy at Lester really at odds with how to do real police work. Lester kind of arguing for loyalty on behalf of Daniels, since, you know, he has had to play both sides of the coin to really advance the trajectory of the major crimes unit. And he kind of has to go back on his own, like, convictions and whatnot. And Lester Freeman, like, understands that dichotomy, or like how confusing or frustrating that could be for him. So he knows that the whole Kentel Williamson thing is kind of a sham, but at the same time, he wants to pay his respect to Daniels for, in one way or another, getting him out of the pawn shop unit. And Jimmy's just not having that. He's total anarchy and wants to pursue the angle that he thinks is the most correct, no matter who it hurts in the process.
And he's like obsessed with the fact that he's, you know, there's some clues that he just can't tie together. It's just selfishness, because there are people dying in you know, Park Heights and whatnot with Kentel Williamson, but he's not interested.
The writing is so great, and that scene so nuanced, because it conveys the frustration of, like, you know, whose side are we supposed to take, since, you know, McNulty does have his eyes on the big prize of bringing down a multifaceted organization that's corrupt on so many different levels. But at the same time, he's like, it's like, your boss is a good guy. Like, you're going to fuck him over?
I think Jimmy's like, he's annoying, so I wouldn't mind seeing him get punched in the face. You know, much needed violence. Like,
it's a Pelicanos episode and a beloved character doesn't die. What's up with that?
What else you want to talk about with the MCU? Is that good? I had the acronym this time.
Good for you, buddy.
Good for us, man.
it's kind of interesting that Lester seems like he's so entrenched in his convictions of showing absolute loyalty to Daniels. But as soon as Jimmy and Kima leave the room, he tells Prez to follow the information that Jimmy and Kima just laid out. So, adding another layer of complexity to the argument that as soon as they're out of the room, he's kind of advocating for his due diligence on a case that they were told not to pursue. So, but, you know, to Lester's credit, again, it seems like he's able to multitask pretty effectively and get a lot of information on Stringer's whereabouts and stuff before McNulty can, while also going after the Kentel Williamson angle. So
yeah, so they all kind of come up with the information through their own methods. Jimmy's more the creeper. He's like spying on Stringer, following him around. So, I mean, kind of just a little unrelated bit of action, you know, as far as their deepening investigation on Stringer's concern. You know, he's showing up pretty drunk to Perlman's row house, or, you know, she's obviously with Daniels, and they had learned that Avon's pretty much getting out. So they're having a pretty interesting interaction. But the whole main point, I brought up this little ending to the storyline of the detail and major crimes team, major crimes unit, is that Jimmy has some interesting things to ask Daniels as they're kind of burying the hatchet, or, you know, I don't know why Daniels feels like he needs, it speaks to his character, I guess, that even this like guy, Jimmy, is just running around drunk yelling, you know, he kind of feels like the need to, you know, make sure everything's cool. So I found that interesting. But then Jimmy asks him, like, he's talking about going down to Ocean City and asks him if he's ever been to the ocean. Like, where did that come from? I mean, it's like, goddamn, Dominic West. I mean, he does have the dialect coach, right? Or that's pretty high level stuff, right? Ocean, ever been there?
Maybe it's like a specific character choice, like only when he's like approaching getting blackout drunk. But kind of an interesting dynamic set up in that whole apology scene, where Daniels explains his perspective on like why he's getting together with Rhonda. He does kind of like, you know, give the rationale of like why they started seeing each other. But there's a kind of like terseness to his apology where it does remind you that like Daniels is fully aware of like what the chain of command is at all times. So he's like kind of like explaining and rationalizing, but I got some kind of like a not like threatening demeanor from him, but definitely like trying to remind McNulty of who he is. Like, look, I'm sorry I'm with your ex right now, but this can't be like a professional problem between us because I can demote you or like ruin your career again. And don't forget where you came from. Like, I got you off the boat. Like, let's just let's get it over with because I don't want to have to take you out because I can't.
Jimmy still gets wasted though, right? Even though he says he's only going to nurse this beer or whatnot. Because as soon as everyone leaves.
Women creepily that are with their boyfriend or husband giving them the Carchetti stare.
You want to talk about him real quick? I mean, old Carchetti's with his pretty, you know what they say? Like Saturdays are for the boys. I mean, if you had to pick a squad to enjoy your Saturdays with, I mean, that's a gem of a group, right, Willie? You know, talking about issues, race, which is always coming up as far as Carchetti, his journey through Baltimore politics is concerned. And, you know, they got some really hot takes. I guess if you substitute hot for racist, Carchetti seems to be, you know, maybe enlightened based on his earlier visit to the West Side and the community meeting with the local precinct. So I don't know, maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but he's at least kind of pushing back a bit, right, about the whole white flight situation and black people not wanting to work for anything. And, you know, he sees the good in the community that's still, you know, still fighting.
Like, again, it's a kind of a misleading thing, like trajectory they have us going on where we see him like ostensibly like understanding the plights of different communities throughout his city and him wanting to come up with solutions to change it. But of course we see him kind of corrupted by the positions of power that he attains. So this is just like one more example of like him, like, you know, this is kind of similar to what Rawls was saying about Bunny in the Comstat meeting, where he's giving vague platitudes just in like reform that wouldn't entice like a 9-year-old girl.
Hey, platitudes get things done. I mean, look at where we're at right now. No, okay. But Carchetti does pretty much confirm that he is eyeing the mayoral candidacy when he talks to Terry, who's turns out to be an old pal. So kind of maybe put some of the creepy stares to, you know, puts that on the back burner for the moment. Like, oh, he, you know, he does know some of these people, or he's not like a complete predator at this stage.
Yeah. I mean, he does say he gives the whole speech on like, oh, I don't want to risk what I have with my wife and kids. But I don't know. I like, even though he's supposedly talking to her as a political confidant, I still think it's like in part of just his game to, you know, be on the hunt like that. I mean, I think he's strategizing for his political career, but I think he's always thinking about that thing.
Yeah, it's like if his crews or whatever you want to call them, his buddies, that's their go-to game. I mean, you know, taking bets on who can, you know, talk to what chick, or, you know, he's already bragging about women and what his conquests. So toxic masculinity, right, Willie? At the base of it all. Talking about toxic, Willie, Avon getting out. We got Levy himself arguing for his client. By the way, I forgot to mention Gangster Webster's lawyer was named Karshesky.
But we do get like a glimpse into like maybe the prison officials having buyer's remorse for taking up with they charged the security guard for having drugs in his car, because now he's using this as leverage, as you know, Bunk would say, like, get out of jail free card. So really frustrating stuff there to see, you know, that they're getting a front row seat to how the game is played, and they don't like how it's treating them unfairly. But Avon knew all along that Levy would have his back and find some way he could weasel his way out of Jessup.
Yeah, things are about to change
in a major way. This is setting up the turf war between him and Marlowe, and it's you know, giving him a renewed lease on life and giving him some vigor, but unfortunately it's gonna end up kind of handicapping him. Well, unfortunately for him, but I don't like, if speaking from a perspective, like you know, he's pretty evil and he does a lot of fucked up things, so maybe it is fortunately that he's getting too bold, and it is gonna eventually see him end up back in jail long term.
Definitely. You know, probably would have worked out better for a lot of people if he would have stayed locked up, but you know, Stringer included, right? So we're gonna get to see all that unfold in our next episode. If you want to wrap it up,
thank you so much to everybody for listening. Again, if you want to donate, that's anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support, where the gods will not save you on all social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And also, we're available via email, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. If you got anything you want to let us know, it's a good way to get in touch too. So thanks.
Thank you to Mostart for doing all the incredible music, the bumpers, the intro, the outro. I think he has some new stuff coming out. I've been seeing him on the social medias plug in some new work, some MF Doom related work, it seems like. So that's really
cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
East MF Doom. You could check out all his work on mostart.com.
Yeah. Thanks also to Andre Tesnes for hooking it up with the emblem and some great design work. So. Appreciate that.
Thank you, everybody. Don't fuck with the program.
Keep it boring. Dead fucking boring.